Right, we're going to South Africa, preferably on QM2. It's a wonderfully elegant experience. So what was the problem in South Africa? In one word, it was apartheid. Apartheid itself was complex. It was not simple. It separated people. It literally means separateness. It didn't just separate black and white. It separated black from black, Indian from African, and colored or mixed race from everybody else. And it was cruel. Everything that had been segregated simply by custom before was now segregated by law. So where black people had, for example, been able to attend liberal English speaking universities, they were now prevented. Grand apartheid was the plan that set up 10 tribal homelands, and all black Africans in South Africa consequently lost their South African citizenship and became putative citizens of their tiny homeland, of which there were 10, and they were supposed to take independence and become internationally recognized countries. Only South Africa ever recognized the 4 that did opt to independence. Independence meant that you got your own defense force and your own diplomats. And the only place you could put your diplomats was Pretoria. And the consequence of having a small army is that 3 of the homelands, and I will get them up in a moment, 3 of the 4 that opted for independence became military dictatorships, having had a military coup. That's South Africa. The 4 homelands that opted for independence were Ciskei, Transkei, Venda, that black blob at the top, and an archipelago of about 7 pieces, which formed Bophuthatswana. So you'd got these objects recognized as independent by the apartheid government, and you'd got 6 other tribal homelands. To some degree, that meant that some black Africans had a stake in the system. So that's grand apartheid, and under it, every black African was supposed to have their family eventually only in the homeland or Bantustan, and they would, if needed as workers in the vast majority of South Africa, they would have to come as single migrant workers, and huge hostels were built to house these single migrant workers, single in inverted commas. There was also Bantu education, which was an inferior education syllabus for Bantu black African schools. This all came in 1948 and was implemented through the 50s. In 1960, there was a big protest in a place called Sharpeville, south of Johannesburg, and that's when violence really set in. 69 protesters were shot, mainly in the back, running away by frightened police after a 5-hour standoff, during which the police were reinforced. So that led to, in response, the founding of a liberation army by the African National Congress, the ANC, which had been founded in 1912 and had been a very gentlemanly operation up to that point, although young leaders like Mandela in the 1940s began to really organize protest against apartheid. So the ANC had been nonviolent, but when armed resistance began, and there were a couple of other small liberation armies as well, then South Africa became a security state with laws suppressing opposition under the name of, sounds familiar, communism and terrorism. So if you were against the government, you were a communist and probably a terrorist as well. So internal opposition was suppressed. And a big external anti-apartheid movement began to come into being. internal unrest really was endemic from 1976 onwards, when in 1976 the school children of Soweto began to rise up against Bantu education. And in the 1980s, there was really chaos. There was one major conflict, the majority against the apartheid government, and there was another conflict as well, which had developed within it and alongside it. And that was the conflict within the black community, which pitted conservative Zulus, organized by the Inkatha movement, in conflict with the progressives of the ANC, especially the younger comrades. So by 1990, both conflicts were raging. The people versus the government, with its police force and army, and the conservative Zulu Inkatha Party versus the ANC, which, although it was banned, had internal supporting movements. And the internal civil war was entirely up at first confined to KwaZulu-Natal here on the coast. So in 1990, in February, the new white president, realizing after apartheid was really collapsing and crumbling from within throughout the 1980s, realizing that there had to be radical change, he unbanned the liberation movements, released Mandela, and expected talks to begin. So there were two expectations. The talking would begin to formulate a new non-racial constitution, and to have the first democratic election, and the ANC Inkatha civil war should stop, because both Mandela and the Inkatha leader Buthelezi had known each other for many years. They did respect each other, and the expectation was that they would meet, but hawks within the ANC prevented any meeting for a year. And meanwhile, that civil war spread up to the townships in the industrial area of Johannesburg and its surrounds. So a crisis was reached when the ANC announced that it would stop talking to the government if the government, for which it blamed all the violence, did not stop the violence by May 1991. And at this point, a group of church and business leaders got together, top leaders, such as Desmond Tutu and the chair of the South African Chamber of Business. And here they are, looking very pleased because they have managed to intervene in the political process. It's the 22nd of June, and they've got everybody who mattered, except the extreme white right, into a meeting to discuss a peace agreement or peace agreements. And they are pictured at the small short photo opportunity for the media before this closed door discussion, which agreed to negotiate what became the National Peace Accord. So we have now a multi-party, multiracial committee forming, under which working groups work on things like a code of conduct for the political parties and agreements for the police to become a police force that is governed by the philosophy of community policing and not a sort of colonial style repressive force. So from this moment on, June 1991, we have the negotiation of the peace accord. And it only takes 3.5 or so months. And in September, the result was the National Peace Accord, which, when printed, is a small booklet of 33 pages, A5 size. It was signed at the National Peace Convention on the 14th of September, 1991, by 29 political and labor organizations, including the top three signatories, de Klerk, Mandela, and Buthelezi. And here they are at the National Peace Convention. The word convention was significant because South Africa was invented at the National Convention of 1908 to 09, when the Union of South Africa was formed out of the four colonies before the post-South African Boer War colonies. So the idea was to have another convention which would be inclusive, and this was the first one. They're all looking rather pleased, and I think it's because Desmond Tutu, who led the prayer at the end, had just told a funny story. However, although they're looking pleased, many of their followers, and Mandela and Buthelezi at least themselves at times still regarded themselves as being at war. They were still keeping their powder dry. There had been efforts at agreements before. Was anything going to be different this time? Well, it was, and the difference lies in one word: implementation. So the National Peace Accord set up peace structures and infrastructure for peace to do peacemaking, peace building, and peacekeeping with the authority of the accord in every corner and locality of South Africa. I think we've been hearing that peace is a messy process and it's hard work. It doesn't just happen. So these structures were homegrown in South Africa. They were based largely on the structures that had worked in industry, especially on the mines, when management and unions had come to agreements, as they did during the 1980s after unions were legalized, to recognize one another and to commit to codes of conduct and to implement these agreements at shop floor level through shop stewards committees. So people, management and unions, knew that this kind of thing could work, and they wanted to transfer it into the political realm. So the National Peace Accord contains codes of conduct, two codes of conduct, one for the political parties, promising not to kill one another, not to take down each other's posters, not to prevent others' members going to meetings, etc., and one for the police, a code of conduct which commits every individual police person to be a servant to the community, and a further set of undertakings by the police which enshrine the new philosophy of community policing. It also contains a standing commission of inquiry into the prevention of public violence and intimidation. Note, not a punitive inquiry, but a healing inquiry to come up with recommendations as to how to do things better in future, which it did. It was the Goldstone Commission. And provisions for socioeconomic reconstruction and development. And vitally, the accord also contains the structures to implement itself. And we can get rid of this. Go away. This is the peace structures as they are first set up. At the top, you've got the National Peace Committee, which is kind of presiding over the whole process and is the fount of consensus legitimacy. Then beside it, you've got the National Peace Secretariat. Its members are in part nominated by the National Peace Committee, but it channels government money, so it sits, in fact, directly under the Department of Justice, first of all, and then Home Affairs. The National Peace Secretariat had the responsibility to set up the regional committees, and so the whole country was divided into 11 regions, and they were at first called dispute resolution committees. After a year or so, they decided to turn their name into peace committees, which the press had already done. And under them, each region had the power to appoint, to call together consultative meetings, which would appoint local dispute resolution committees or local peace committees. So you've got the national, the regional, and the local committees with a good deal of subsidiarity, because South Africa is a very varied place, and each region, for example, the Western Cape would be very different from the Northern Cape and from the far north and from KwaZulu-Natal. So each region had a lot of power to decide how it would approach matters. And again, each local committee also had a good deal of local power. And it was a top-down rolling out, but with a lot of consultation, and in the end, a lot of buy-in at grassroots. So the Goldstone Commission had its own committees of inquiry and investigation units. Beside this is the police board, which did a lot of workshopping and thinking, the top police leaders and leaders of civil society, expert criminologists and so on, actually putting together the strategy of community policing for the South African police. So the structures developed, and in particular added these divisions for communications, training, facilitation, full-time facilitators working under the accord, some fundraising for socioeconomic reconstruction and development, and its own office. And the National Peace Committee developed a complaints investigating committee of lawyers, which helped to draw the sting of complaints about this party and that party had breached the accord and so on. The members, importantly, civil society is represented on the National Peace Committee and the regional and local committees, largely religious bodies and business and community groups, and also the security forces, and of course the political parties. So coming together for the first time ever in the history of South Africa. Here is, let me get rid of all this. And then I've got to now. I'm about to show you a picture of Atypical Local Peace Committee. Having a weekend away. So this is Alexandra Township, Johannesburg. And here you've got the IFP, the ANC, the army, detective type police, the internal riot security police, the internal stability unit, it was called, or the instability unit, if you like, the head of Women for Peace in Alexandra, Heather from business, Brian from business, me from churches, displaced people, and this guy is from the hostels, the Inkatha-dominated hostels. So this is September 1992. We've been going since April, and Alexandra is beginning to lose its violent image. The tasks of the committees were conflict resolution, so a lot of training in conflict resolution, mainly Harvard-based, so a lot about positions and interests and needs, and training and facilitation, and implementing the codes of conduct, above all, by joint planning and monitoring of events, such as rallies and marches and funerals, which had always been deadly flashpoints before, but now became an opportunity for joint pre-planning and coordinated action to produce a peaceful event and debriefing afterwards. So this was the meaning of peace monitoring under the accord. And this is what it could look like on the ground. And these are Inkatha rally goers being separated from the ANC lot, and there were thousands in each crowd, and they're passing each other at a crossroads by agreement with peace monitors and international observers. We had them from the UN, Commonwealth, Europe, and the OAU, all working with the peace committees. And they're standing in a line to separate the otherwise warring groups of Inkatha and ANC rally goers. And monitor training developed, and so did what monitors wore. This is election day, when the peace structures fielded 18,500 locally trained peace monitors and had the best communications and logistics operation of any organization, except perhaps the army, and materially helped with the peaceful election that South Africa had in April 1994. So this is Bishop Peter Story of the Methodist Church and two monitors in Soweto on election day. We also began to implement socioeconomic reconstruction and development, and expected to do a lot more after the 1994 election. Now, the other thing that the peace structures did was publicity, communicating the idea and the hope of peace, and mobilizing the whole nation to get involved in doing things for peace. So by September 1993, this was working. The peace song became a unifying anthem for the country, and the new peace doves symbol was everywhere, and everyone wanted the t-shirt, and literally millions were either given or sold. And there was a peace day on the 2nd of September 1993, so it's taken 2 years to get to that point. Here's a clip of one of the TV adverts.
Only if we all work together and spread a message of peace, can we build a future for our children.
Let's show them all well, we can bring peace in our land.
And I think that's probably all I've got time for at the moment. Thank you.